Welcome to the Building Jerusalem podcast. My name's Stephen Neal, the pastor at Alder Bethel Church and blogger at Building Jerusalem.
And my name's Stephen Watkinson, minister at St. Luke's and St. Peter's in Rochdale and blogger at Northern Souls.
So we're joined here today by Sam Anderson. Sam, do you want to tell us where you're from?
Yeah, from East London originally, born and bred. Studied at Oak Hill, and so we're in North London. And we're heading off to sunny Oldham this summer.
Sunny Oldham, awesome. So I've basically brought you here to rub it in the face of Stephen that he doesn't have anyone to work with.
Yeah, not at the moment, but you know, Rochdale is still sunnier than Oldham.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. So, Sam, what was it that led you up to come into Oldham?
Well, we're just thinking about where we should be in the UK. I think we heard John Stevens give his kind of State of the Nation address on one of these at the Hub conference, actually, for people thinking about ministry. And my eyes were open just to kind of need the rest of the country. I've only ever thought of London is my home. I've only lived in London, and then just felt God's call to kind of make a sacrifice and go outside London, explore different options. Saw your little video at the conference.
Our little video.
Yeah, that's
someone else called it a little video as well. That seems to be
I haven't seen
it.
Your little video.
Have you not?
No, obviously it's something I've missed out on.
Well, it's because the FIEC are doing these in-house videos so that different churches in the network can pray for each other, and apparently Anglicans don't pray for each other. So,
well, we don't pray for the FIEC, no.
Yeah, okay. We pray for you, but you need it more than we do.
Yeah, I think you're praying that we're converted, though, aren't you?
That's right. That's absolutely right. So what was it that specifically convinced you that Oldham was the place to be, other than obviously working with me?
Me and my wife were praying and thinking it through. We're really keen to work in an urban deprived area, because that's where I grew up in Newham, particularly a really multicultural area, an area of lots of Muslims, and we're keen to get involved in Muslim ministry. So it kind of ticked a lot of those boxes. And something I feel I've been prepared for from my life experience as well, from where I grew up.
Okay, and is the church that you're in at the moment in a particularly Muslim area or hard area of London, or not particularly?
I think it's quite a hard area of London. There are much more deprived areas, but it's kind of like your typical kind of small residential, not particularly well off residential area of London. So it's a mix of different international people. There's not tons of Muslims in that bit, particular bit, so it's in Enfield, because it's close to college, it's my placement church. But you do get a real mix of people, not just kind of like one class, but kind of a smattering of different people.
Okay, and on sort of first blush, what would be your main differences between where you are in London and where you are now in Oldham?
I think there's definitely a lot more people with money and an opportunity. Definitely from what I've seen of Oldham so far is that, you know, most of the church, kind of either they're asylum seekers in Oldham Bethel Church or retired and don't really have the same kind of opportunities. Whereas even if you're in a poor bit of London, you can, you know, jump on a tube, ride a bike and get somewhere where you can get a bit of work. So there's more opportunities. It's a slightly different kind of feel, but with similar issues, I think.
Okay, so you'd say same sort of problems, but different level of opportunity for people if they want to aspire, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Stephen, you had a curate with you a while ago.
A trainee, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, trainee. The curates are trainees, aren't they?
Yeah, he came to me before he went to train at college, and he'll be a curate in a year or so.
So he's a trainee?
Yeah, it takes a very long time before you're allowed to be a proper vicar.
Awesome. So you passed the test, obviously.
But I did start going towards it in 2003.
Okay, so took a while.
It did take a long time, but yeah, sorry, that's a side issue.
But you had that fellow with you. How did you find working with somebody who was in the church as, you know, not a vicar, if you like, and I know your structures are a bit different to ours, but how did you find working with somebody like that?
It's always great having an extra pair of hands, isn't it? And particularly someone who is sort of clear biblically, theologically, someone who has a heart to do ministry and all that kind of thing. And I think that's really good. I think for a lot of people, if you haven't experienced the Northern Milltown, Northern Milltowns are just different, and so there's inevitably going to be a bit of a culture shock in that. And I think that can be it's just an eye-opener. It's a different culture. It was when we came to Northern Milltowns and we grew up in the Northwest. So that those kind of things can be helping people who come to, whether they're coming to sort of work as part of your team or whether they're moving to be part of your congregation or whatever, there's issues with that, isn't there?
So in your church, what did you have your trainee doing?
Yeah, he did all kinds of bits and pieces of ministry, I suppose. So he did loads of practical stuff like putting services together and websites and all that kind of thing, which is just really useful in taking burden off me. He did some stuff in terms of Bible studies and sort of teaching in that sense. He did was very much an extra pair of hands at things like our outreach or in our services or whatever it was, that there was someone there who could you could sort of rely was going to be there, which was just helpful for our congregation in the sense of we don't have loads of people, and just actually having one other person who was going to be there just meant that less the burden was spread a bit more, that kind of thing.
And I'm guessing you have the same problem that we do, which is you don't have tons of money to draw on. So how did you manage to get a guy to come and work with you when you don't have any money?
Essentially they came as a volunteer, so we didn't employ them, then they found support so that they could manage. So that sort of, in some ways, that deals with a bunch of issues. They came from a big church, and so had they knew they were coming for a period of time, and so that was a runner. In other situations, that wouldn't be a runner, would it? You'd need to be employed.
So that's what I'm going to ask Sam, because Sam's going to be employed by us. Because in our setup, really, you're either employed or not, really. So how have we managed to fund you, given that we're a church full of asylum seekers and people with no money?
Well, it's just been externally through generosity of other Christian brothers and sisters. I mean, we've had to apply for trust funds and different things, and kind of there's been a lot of kind of getting our name out, isn't there, and talking about the ministry in Oldham and places like it. And I think people are kind of seeing that the great need, but I mean, basically we can't raise the money ourselves, can we? We've got a church, half of which are asylum seekers, not a penny to their name, and then the other half, you know, most of them are not working or they're on benefits, so it's going to have to come from elsewhere.
Yeah, and so it's a case of sort of talking to churches, talking to individuals, writing letters, applying for funds, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And seeing what we can scrape together, really.
One of the things that's hard about that, isn't it? So, like you said at the start, we haven't got anyone at the moment. And ideally, what we would be doing is offering job opportunities, as in ministry job opportunities, that we were paying properly, you know, and that kind of thing. When you're a small church, actually the effort of doing that is quite substantial. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff you've got to get in place for that to actually work. And one of the reasons we probably haven't followed up with that is that I think one of the things I looked at is ideally you would have someone who you were paying for 3 years or something like that, but you've got to get a stack of money in place for that. You've got to get a stack of kind of employment stuff in place for that. And when there's just you to sort all that out, that's just quite difficult.
Well, that's exactly what we've done with Sam. So Sam's come in for 3 years initially, and our plan really was to cost that and then go and ask for money. But like you say, we've got to have employment stuff. Now, we're quite fortunate because we're an independent church, that's largely in place for me anyway.
Yeah.
And what we've essentially done is gone, copy exactly what is the setup for me, and then we'll just sort of transfer that over to Sam. I mean, we realised the other day we hadn't written a contract for him yet. So I was knocking that up on my computer the other day, And the way we did that was I just looked at my contract and went, that'll do.
Yeah.
And we've run with that.
And that's interesting. So for us, because there's a structure in the Church of England, so it's fine if I'm getting a curate, because that's all dealt with. It's not so straightforward if I'm trying to get a someone that the church is employing, as opposed to, so I'm not employed by the church, I'm employed by the church commissioners, I think, essentially. So it works at a kind of different level.
Do you want to explain what the church commissioners are? Because I don't really know what
they are. Well, I'm not sure I do exactly, but so I am paid by the church commissioners. And the church commissioners are the ones who centrally manage the finances, I think, of the Church of England. And it is quite a complicated financial structure in the Church of England, because obviously we're split up into dioceses, and parishes pay into dioceses, dioceses pay into the centre, and then the money comes out of the centre for the for ministry. But I have to admit, I don't quite know exactly how that works. But if you work within those routes and you employ someone as a, or you are given a curate, that's all very straightforward, because basically someone else sort of that out.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do it yourself, then you haven't got anything initially to work with. So that's why we went with a volunteer basis to start off with, because we couldn't work out how we were going to do that.
So how does having a volunteer as opposed to an employee fit with your polity?
Yeah, so I think by and large it was like having a enthusiastic, supportive congregation member, and that was the right way of seeing it. I think it's tricky when you start to think of your polity in terms of, so within the Church of England, the people who are the leaders have a bishop's license. So whether they are like me as the vicar, or my assistant, or my readers, or whatever, they have a license.
So does that mean basically the bishop says you're okay to practice as a vicar? That's the idea.
Well, you're okay to, it's really you're okay to preach, basically. But the license for a vicar and an assistant is one thing, and then it's slightly different for a reader.
Okay.
A reader can preach.
So I've got a quick question I want to ask about that, and then I want to go back to the original question, which is, so if there's a license to preach, how does that work when people like me, who are not Anglican, get invited in to speak as outside speakers?
So it depends a bit what we invite you to do. There are things I couldn't invite you to do, just couldn't invite you to do, so you can't do a communion service for us or something like that.
Wouldn't want to carry on.
No, that's fine, you're not welcome. But then by and large, as kind of say, for example, what we invited you to was an evening thing, which is was a slightly different kind of come and talk to us about a topic. I think if I get you to preach, then I need permission from the bishop, technically, although not everyone follows through on that.
So how are you distinguishing those two things? Because from memory, I turned up at your church and opened up a Bible and read it out and went, this is what the passage is saying and how it applies to your people.
Yeah, so, but that's, this is going to sound complicated, but that service is, or that evening thing wasn't a formal service in the church.
It wasn't Vespers.
Exactly. so it was what we were doing. We were doing these kind of hot topic meetings, looking at particular issues and questions. So I think within that context, that's one thing. I think actually even since then, probably it's got a bit tighter, because they've done some stuff on safeguarding that I think has tightened it up. But so there's that. But then if it's a formal service, I think you have to be more, you have to seek the bishop's permission, which wouldn't normally be withheld.
Okay.
Withheld.
So I'm going to drag this back then to the original question about volunteers in the church.
In terms of how it fits in? Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in some ways, I don't think it's ideal. I suppose it's an issue of being part of a fairly fixed and historic denomination that has its structures, and then it doesn't change with the times very quickly. So actually within the Church of England, there's been quite a push to get people doing kind of years out doing things and stuff like this, that you might sort of think of, you know, evangelical churches often do like trainees, and there have been sort of roles for a long time. There's a role called parish assistant, which was that kind of role, but it's that you do feel that you're off, stuff hasn't moved very quickly, and therefore you want to do something, and how does that fit in? I suppose the way we looked at it with that guy was he really fits in as an enthusiastic congregation member who is, you know, looking at going into ministry, and was going through that process. So it was right that we were giving him opportunities, because that's what he should be doing as he was looking at the process. So he worked in that particular way. I think it genuinely, so if you think of big churches where they employ quite a lot of people to do stuff, it's quite odd really in that they're employing them almost entirely outside of the structures of the Church of England. And they'll often have a staff team, like a senior staff or something like that. And that might well include the ordained people who have the license, etc., and some other people, like, I don't know, the youth worker or the women's worker or something like that. And quite how that works within the polity is quite difficult.
Well, that's interesting, because I've seen that trend in free churches now. So again, it will depend on your polity. I'm just going to talk about ours quickly, and then I'm going to talk about the trend I've seen. So it's interesting you talk about the enthusiastic church member, because we have somebody with us who we don't employ. They are in church membership though, and essentially they've set themselves up such that they can do full-time evangelism, but they're not employed by the church, even though they're a church member. And we've essentially viewed them in exactly the same way. We've kind of gone, well, that's your job that you've decided you're going to do over there. We're happy to support you in that, like we would any other church member being supported in that, but ultimately you're not employed by the church, and therefore, you know, the church isn't going to necessarily direct everything you're going to be doing over there. As a church member, you will be subject to the same sort of things as church members, and therefore we'd expect you to be an enthusiastic member. So we have got somebody in that situation. Sam is not going to be in that situation. Sam's going to be a staff member, so to speak. But then you start getting into all sorts of interesting discussions. We had a discussion about this a while ago.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
So what title have we landed on for you?
Was it Gospel Lackey in the end?
Gospel Lackey was what we were throwing around for a long time.
I think officially it was Gospel Worker.
We felt Worker would probably land better with the funds.
That's right, yeah.
So he's a Gospel Worker. But we had a conversation about this, because is he an assistant pastor? Is he a trainee pastor? Is he something else altogether? And as I was thinking it through, I mean, I just don't think these are categories that the Bible recognises.
Yeah.
And I think we get ourselves into massive problems when we start coming up with these sort of semi-roles. So assistant ministers generally are trainee roles, and my experience is often they're not on the eldership. They are often non-elder roles, but are training to be an elder role. Mm. Then you get people who hilariously are brought in as, like, I don't know, a trainee pastor or pastoral trainee or something, and then they become a trainee pastor, or they start as an assistant minister or assistant to the minister or some really nuanced term. Then they sort of switch the terms around from ministry assistant or something to assistant minister. But basically, the guy's doing exactly the same job. The stuff hasn't changed. It's just there's some sort of formal recognition by the church that something has changed. But what seems to have changed is entirely unclear to me. And as I was talking with Sam, and my view was really there are kind of two categories Scripture recognises. You've got sort of church officers, so you've got the elders and the deacons, and you've got sort of non-office roles, if you like. Now, in our polity, we believe in the priesthood of all believers. We believe all members are ministers of the church. And so, essentially, you're either a lay member, or you are a staff member, or you are a lay elder, or you are a staff elder. And I struggle to see many biblical categories beyond that.
And in a sense, really, your lay staff just means not full-time paid.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would make lay. I would use the word lay to mean unpaid, effectively, or not employed in some way, or not holding office in some way. Whereas I would use staff just to mean paid, basically.
Yeah, and that's difficult, isn't it? Because you might want to staff someone to do, well, I mean, anything. I mean, it might just be to do the admin for you, or
so,
something.
So let's take that example. So I would say if I had employed Sam basically to do our filing for our 3 days a week, which is
exciting.
Don't tell him that's likely to be half his job.
That wasn't in the contract.
Not much was in the contract, but if we did employ him to do that, but we go, obviously someone doing your filing, I'm not going to make you an elder on, because that's not particularly an eldership role. I would say you're still a staff member because you're being paid, but you're a staff member. Everybody else, most people are lay members of the church, so they are members who are not employed in any way by the church to do anything formal. You get your staff members who might be employed to do a whole variety of things. So actually, if you take the standard ministry trainee model, mm-hmm. on my polity, they are effectively staff members.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't make them an elder, but I would have them in some way supported by the church. And generally, the way our polity works is rather than go, so we didn't say to Sam, which we could have done, we could have said, you go and get funding for yourself, get all the support for yourself, then we will have you as a volunteer in our church who is funded externally. We could have done that, but what we said was, go and get funding that will come to the church, mm-hmm. and then the church will use that funding to support you, so you are actually employed and supported by the church, because that fits more comfortably with our polity.
Yeah, no, I think I think one of the things for us, and I guess I can see that with what you're doing, that some of it is this just beginning to work out what we mean. I think evangelicals are often a bit slack on their polity anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
And quite pragmatic, and so what tends to happen is a church perhaps is growing or whatever, and they'll look at it and go, what we could really do with is a children's and families worker, or something like that. So that, you know, maybe the senior minister, whatever, looks at it and goes, I've just got so much work to do in that area, I can't do my other stuff. And so that's what they do, and they get someone, and they don't necessarily really think, well, how does that fit in my, and I think it is really, so that kind of pace is a really hard question, isn't it? So they are they an elder? Do you know what I mean? When you kind of looking at it, and I think probably like what you're saying, even if they are someone that you think, yeah, actually they should be an elder, if you're employing someone in from outside, bringing them straight into the eldership, I'm talking more in your polity terms, but we wouldn't think entirely differently on that kind of level. It would be quite odd, wouldn't it, to employ them straight into the eldership?
But then, I agree. So I one of the conversations we had. But do you want to tell folk what we had discussions about eldership?
Well, yeah, it's a tricky one, that one, isn't it? Because I think there are some churches. I definitely know that in some independent churches would have that kind of almost like a fly-in elder. Mm. So if you go back to the kind of assistant minister kind of roles, they're flying in as a staff member and an elder on the basis of, you know, the interview process and all of that. But I can understand why you wouldn't want that, because you do want congregational buy-in on that person. And particularly if a church has history of kind of splits or other things, you definitely want all of your congregation to kind of affirm that person as an elder, someone that they can submit to. So that I think that would be preferable.
So what's interesting about it is, I would never make somebody an elder who've just recently joined my church under almost any circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the conversations we had when we were looking at appointing you, I think Sam quite understandably said, you know, I'd like eldership to be part of a conversation that we're having going forward.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would have never have gone, come and join us and be an elder straight away. I just wouldn't do that. But interestingly, that all goes out the window when you appoint a pastor.
Well, I was thinking that, And I suppose that's just really, so in a context where we're not appointing from eldership from within, I mean, that's the issue we're talking about, yeah. Basically, if you're not appointing from within, then that's very difficult, isn't it? And I mean, interestingly, I suppose from an Anglican polity, what you have there in principle is that there's a denominational process that is supposed to be the guarantee behind the elder, if you see what I mean, that they are of the right character, that they are of the right skills and stuff.
And how's that working out for your church?
Brilliantly. but you can sort of see how in principle, and actually it used to be much stronger. I mean, the congregation used to have, well, and in fact the minister themselves used to have very little say. The bishop used to go and phone up and go, actually I want you to go there. It's like, okay. But that has changed a bit. But so you can sort of see how that works out, in, you know, if you're going to trust in that as a system, which, as you say, hasn't always been hugely effective.
I think the way we would kind of justify doing that, I'm not saying this is the way you should do it, but I think the way most dissenting churches would justify it would be to say, well, look, the scriptural principle is don't be quick to make anyone an elder. And so if your process is robust outside,
I think that's fair.
Yeah, then you can, you know, as long as you're not kind of going, this guy's applied, we've heard him preach once.
Seems all right.
He's going to be the pastor now, yeah.
He's very funny. He's got a good sense of humor.
That's right. I think if you're not doing that, but you've got a proper process in where you're hearing him not just preach once but several times, where maybe even he comes and stays with people in the church for a period of time where they get to know him and live with him to see what he's like with his family, and there's a period of time, and as long as that's laid out up front, and you say, look, we're not going to be doing this over the course of like a 4-week recruitment process, it's going to be, you know, much longer, I think that is not illegitimate, because as far as you can ever know somebody from outside, as long as you're putting in a process where you can know them as well as you might, doesn't mean it's going to be foolproof, and nothing is foolproof, but I think if you're putting in proper process for people coming in from outside so you can properly judge what they're like, then I think you can say it's not unreasonable to have someone step in as a pastor.
Well, I suppose in terms of our context, so I was joking before about how long it took to become a vicar, but that is the process, and so the whole point is that all the way through you're being assessed, first of all, whether you can go to train, when you have trained, have you achieved what you should have achieved in training, when you get to curacy, you've got to pass your curacy, which is a whole load of stuff, so and you get this what's it called, free to receive, or so, like your bishop has to sign you off before anyone, you know, it's the same in terms of if I were to move job within the Church of England, my bishop would have to sort of say I was okay, you know, that I was free from any discipline and all that kind of stuff. So there is quite a, that sense, is it? And sometimes free churches have looked at the Anglican Church and that sort of process and kind of gone, wow, actually that's really good. And I think that's true. Although, as you've already mentioned, you kind of go, well, your process is then only as good as the results, and so clearly there are some things that are problematic with that, but
and truth be told, when we were appointing you, it's not like we've sort of met you 1 week and gone, do you want a job? I mean, I know you're not going to be an elder straight away, but we've had a bit more of a process than that, and I mean, you stayed with people in the church
different elders, and I think that's important. I think it is an issue when you employ staff. Particularly if it's not carefully thought through, we can kind of default to a kind of normal career interview process, rather than kind of thinking carefully, okay, is there anything else we've missed out biblically? I think you kind of touched on character. If someone's living with you, it makes a massive difference, doesn't it? You can, you know, hopefully if they can come with their family, they come with their wife, you get to see how they interact. That's completely different to today's, you know, turn up for interview, and okay, in the Christian circle, you might have, it might be a little bit more drawn out. You might have a preach or something like that. But then if we're just looking at gifting and ability to teach, I think we can often miss out other more important aspects, like the character, like the, you know, the biblical, the wider biblical kind of, what does an elder look like? Which is quite hard in that little short, sharp burst.
And I think that's really helpful. And what I'd like to do is maybe try and explore exactly that in the next session.